This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Inflation. We report, you decide. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 13th of December. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. Okay, so as promised, here is the reporting. Consumer prices in November did go up, but less than everybody had been guessing. Inflation's running at 7.1% year on year. That is down from 7.7% at an annual clip a month ago. The month-on-month increase was down as well, a 0.1% in November compared to 0.4% in October. Yes, a lot of numbers, I know, but that's the way you got to talk about inflation. Now, here comes the you decide part. Is this the news we've all been waiting for, that inflation is actually fading? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more on what might be ahead.
Prices fell the most at the gas pump and the gas meter. Gasoline prices were down 2% just in November. Utility gas was down 3.5%. This is compared to the month before. Prices for everything else, besides energy and food, rose the least they have risen in a month since August of 2021. Andrew Lipsman is a principal analyst at Insider Intelligence.
Really, ever since this summer, the worst factors of exaggerated demand have started to moderate, and the factors that had really constrained supply were starting to get better.
Used car prices actually fell year over year, 3%. The cost of shelter, that's basically rent, still rose 0.6% in November, but that is the lowest jump we've seen since July. That said, the Fed is probably still going to raise interest rates by 0.5% tomorrow. Eric Winograd is senior economist at AllianceBernstein.
I expect that they will signal an intent to raise rates again thereafter, but to be open-minded about the fact that with inflation peaking and starting to come down, if it does decelerate faster, they may not raise rates as far as people would have expected 4 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago.
Winograd says the labor market needs to cool before we get inflation closer to the Fed's target of 2%. That could take a while, and there are long-term labor supply issues getting in the way, says Tuan Nguyen, U.S. economist with RSM.
Long COVID, early retirement, and slow population growth will have a long-lasting impact.
And supply chains may be healing, but they're also moving and getting a bit more expensive, Nguyen says.
Reshoring, rebuilding a more resilient supply chain system, and the decoupling from China will keep the cost higher for longer.
For now, though, inflation does appear to be coming down, and analysts expect us to get down to 4% next year. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
It can be instructive to dig into those monthly government economic reports like the CPI to try to get a sense of what's going on under the hood, so to speak. And among the goods for which prices have indeed come down some are used cars. Fifth month in a row of falling prices last month. Used car prices now 3.3% lower than they were a year ago. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
Let's get one thing straight right off the bat. Used cars are still a lot more expensive than they were a couple of years ago.
You might remember, you know, it wasn't that long ago, we were seeing 30% year-over-year increases in used vehicle pricing.
Mike Wall is with S&P Global Mobility, a marketplace underwriter.
So this kind of erosion, not necessarily unexpected either. It's sort of the laws of gravity to some extent. You know, what goes up eventually will start to come down.
At least a little. Michelle Krebs at Cox Automotive says part of the reason that's happening now is that the cost of so much else has been going up.
Some used car shoppers have been pushed out because they have other priorities. Everything is costing them more, and so they're putting off buying a car perhaps because they've got heat to pay for and groceries have gone up.
Interest rates on used car loans have gone way up too, she says, which is also driving demand down.
Because the math just doesn't work for some people when you look at the monthly payment.
On the supply side, the number of used cars available has returned to a more normal level. Sam Fiorani at Auto Forecast Solutions says that change is visible.
It's interesting to drive by a car dealership and see used cars on the lot, whereas just a couple years ago, those lots were vacant. It was amazing to drive by a car dealership and not see cars out front.
But even though all that's helped bring prices down a bit, Fiorani says it's unlikely they'll drop all the way back to pre-pandemic levels anytime soon. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street on this Tuesday, big jump at the open on that CPI number, then a long, slow slide, then a rally at the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Reserve's two-day meeting on interest rates and on the general health of this economy started this morning in Washington. It is, in case you're keeping track, their last meeting of this very eventful monetary policy year. Now, regular listeners to this program will know that I'm a history guy and thus a firm believer that history matters. So I want to tell you a little story about the guy whose name is on the Federal Reserve building in Washington.
Mariner Eccles
ran the Fed from 1934 to 1948. That's the Great Depression through the aftermath of the Second World War. Those voices you heard were Sarah Binder. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Nina Eihacker. She's an assistant professor at the University of Rhode Island. And Robert Hetzel.
I went to work for the Richmond Fed in 1975. So I am history. And in fact, December 16th, the University of Chicago Press will have out my third book on monetary history.
That book is 697 pages long. We do not have time for that much history. But we've gathered the three of them together, students of the Fed as they are, to tell you a story about one guy in one moment, a story really about who's responsible for managing the federal government's debt. And the story starts
during World War II.
December 7th, 1941. No American will ever forget this Sunday morning.
As the U.S. turns to war, there's pressure from Treasury on the Fed to keep interest rates low so that it would be easier for the Treasury Department to finance the debt.
Oh, sure.
I want to help my Uncle Sam.
Well, you sure?
And I also want to help myself. Well, therefore, I'm going to buy plenty of those defense bonds and stamps.
That's the boy.
That was Nina Eihacker and Sarah Binder again. Also, Abbott and Costello urging Americans to buy war bonds.
See, Uncle Sam needs that money to build ships and planes, tanks.
And what?
Tanks.
You're welcome.
Remember, low interest rates make all that debt that the government's issuing cheaper. So to help out Uncle Sam in the middle of a war, Eccles and the Federal Open Market Committee agreed to keep the rate on long-term Treasury bonds below 2.5%.
So the other side of this was that Mariner Eccles was worried that issuing debt could foster inflation. But out of a commitment to the president, Eccles stifled those concerns and allowed the Federal Reserve to purchase those bonds as they were issued, keeping interest rates low.
They saw it as an emergency measure.
Time goes on, and we come to June of 1950, and the Korean War breaks out.
U.S. planes and U.S. ships are ordered into action. Based in Japan.
By this point, Truman's in the White House. Eccles isn't the Fed chair anymore. That's a whole separate story. But he is still on the interest rate setting Federal Open Market Committee.
Truman is very, very determined that the Fed is going to continue this rate peg so he can finance the war cheaply.
Except
households are once again worried that they're going to face shortages, that they're going to see rationing, and that leads to an increase in prices.
They're simply reminding all Americans that hoarding doesn't pay. Don't sell America short. Don't buy America short.
It's an inflation shock.
Here's the inflation shock. Prices were actually falling in the first half of 1950. Deflation, technically, at an annual rate of about 2%. Then, by January of 1951, inflation was running at almost 8%. Prices going up fast. So the Fed really did not want to commit to Truman's plan to keep interest rates low.
But they have to get Treasury to back down.
Treasury and the White House.
So, in the midst of all of this, Truman invites Mariner Eccles and other Fed officials.
The FOMC tromps over to the White House.
Up to the White House. And basically gives them a dressing down.
Truman and his Treasury Secretary, a buddy of his, by the way, named John Wesley Snyder, say to the Fed, in essence, hey, there's a war on.
If you give in and let rates rise, Truman had a line something like, Stalin wins.
It got a little contentious.
And there's no resolution. The Fed doesn't back down.
And when the meeting is over, Truman and Snyder announce that the Fed has agreed to maintain this peg of 2.5%. Well, the FOMC didn't agree to that at all.
They made no clear commitment.
The White House and Truman had lied, and there was no resolution.
Okay, it got very contentious.
Eccles is outraged.
That sent him blistering mad.
And so he leaks the story to the Washington Post and the New York Times that this was fabricated.
After the Times and the Post publish the Fed's account of that meeting, it becomes clear that Congress isn't going to back Truman and the Treasury Department.
Treasury knows that it's in a box and Congress will no longer back it up. So it knows it has to come to some kind of agreement with the Fed.
And so we get to March the 4th, 1951, and something called the Treasury-Fed Accord.
We call it the Accord? I think it's more of a divorce. We're breaking up the ties, which are driving us crazy.
Henceforth, the Fed will be in charge of monetary policy, and the U.S. Treasury will be in charge of debt.
The Fed's free to raise interest rates.
So here we are, 4 or so minutes into this story, and you're probably wondering why I'm telling you all this. Well, this is why.
The move to split the connection between the Federal Reserve and the Treasury facilitated the development of a gigantic private market for government debt.
What we call the bond market.
The federal government has something like $31 trillion in outstanding debt right now, a little bit more than that, actually. And over the next couple of months, you are going to start hearing a lot about it again as Republicans try to leverage that debt for policy and political advantage.
We take for granted that there will always be people and institutions and investors who are willing to buy up America's debt. And the growth of the United States and our ability to respond, not just to war abroad, but say to the global pandemic, depends on Treasury knowing that there's a stable bond market.
And you can, at least in part, thank Mariner Eccles for that.
The availability and the strength of American debt comes out of that period.
So he has a lot to do with the economy we have today.
Of course, there are decades of monetary policy history between the Treasury-Fed Accord of 1951 and the economy we have today.
If you're interested, I've summarized this very briefly in 697 pages.
It is, we should tell you, available for pre-order now. Thanks again to Robert Hetzel with the Mercatus Center, Sarah Binder, she's at Brookings, and Nina Eihacker at the University of Rhode Island. SBF and FTX are the cryptocurrency initials of the day today. Sam Bankman-Fried, the founder and former CEO of the defunct crypto exchange FTX, found himself in a courtroom in the Bahamas this morning, arrested, as you've heard, at the request of the American government for the circumstances surrounding the implosion of FTX. Bankman-Fried indicated he is going to fight extradition to the United States, where federal prosecutors have indicted him for fraud and conspiracy. Also today in Washington, where the guest of honor would have been SBF, if not for the aforementioned indictment, The now CEO of FTX, who was steering the company through bankruptcy, said it has taken losses of more than $7 billion and that what happened looks like, and this is a quote, old-fashioned embezzlement. So amid this veritable tsunami of bad crypto headlines, do you suppose it's possible for crypto to get its mojo back? Marketplace's Lily Jamali has that story.
This moment just might be the beginning of the end for crypto, according to Duke's Lee Reiners, who says all signs pointed to that in today's congressional hearing.
The main takeaway was just the complete lack of internal controls at all the FTX entities, including a lack of books and records.
Reiners says the problem isn't the industry itself.
It's the product that the industry is selling. You know, cryptocurrencies are just digital assets that are created out of thin air.
Assets that he says trade purely on speculation. Reiners is among the critics who says crypto has had 14 years to find what it calls its killer use case, its economic value. Supporters say they've only had 14 years. Kristen Smith is executive director of the Blockchain Association.
This is a very novel technology. There's a lot of development going on, and most of the promising applications in this space haven't yet reached a point where they're ready for use on a mass scale. So we have to give it time to build.
Even after the collapse of two cryptocurrencies, a crypto hedge fund, and now FTX, Smith says the industry has the infrastructure to survive.
This is a setback, but I do think it is one that the industry ultimately will be able to overcome.
But the industry can't rebuild trust on its own, says former commodities regulator Timothy Massett, who's now at Harvard. He says regulators have to play a part.
We need basic standards to protect customer assets adequately. We need standards to prevent the operation of conflicting businesses.
And prohibit entities from trading with themselves. Good for the public and the industry, too, as it keeps looking for that killer use case. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I don't want to say I'm a creature of habit, but everything's pretty much the same.
Habits sometimes don't come cheap, though. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 103 today, 0.3%, 34,108. The NASDAQ added 113 points, a little over 1%, 11,256. The S&P 500 found 29 points, just shy of 0.75%, 4,019. Today's lower than expected CPI could mean that interest rates won't get too much higher and might not stay too high for too long. And Wall Street interpreted that is great news for the semiconductor industry, which borrows a lot of money to build new plants. NVIDIA gained 3%. Advanced Micro Devices at an almost 1.4%. Applied Materials pocketed just over 2.25%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.50%. 3.5% is another way to say that. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Holiday travel is never, you know, great. But here in the late stage pandemic economy, we're starting to see some new patterns as working remotely is letting people have more flexibility in planning their trips and their time off. Used to be in the before times that the Wednesday before and the Sunday after Thanksgiving were the busiest days. But data from the TSA shows travel is now spread out over a longer period as people basically can bring their work with them. So this mixing of business and pleasure at the holidays has a whole lot of benefits, of course, but some complications as well, as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports.
Before remote work became common, a trip to visit family during the winter holidays was a whole production, says Julie Swenson, a social media manager in Edina, Minnesota.
When you go away for a week, you feel like you're going away for the next 10 years. Like, it just, you've got to get everything done and get everybody up to speed and find a backup for every little thing. Leave the office and, you know, use your precious PTO for flying time.
Her sister and her mom live in Arizona, so she'd always be flying at the busiest, most expensive, most stressful times, parachuting in for a short visit, then rushing back home to work. Now, she's taking longer trips, spending time with her family outside the hectic holiday feasts. She can savor quiet coffee breaks with her mom or silly playtime with her three-year-old nephew.
I could never have done that in the old days. In fact, I wouldn't have taken that trip in the old days because it was such a hot and heavy time at work, but I could just keep right up because of remote work, which is just a wonderful gift, really.
Really. And yet, there are trade-offs. The Wi-Fi can be fickle, the three-year-old can be distracting, and mom isn't always understanding when Swenson needs to break away to meet a deadline.
For me, things get too blended when we travel.
All that work-life balance many people have found over the last couple years by working from home can be thrown into disarray once we're with our families, says Ashley Willens, a social psychologist at Harvard Business School.
When we think about working from our parents' house, we're thinking about the food and the wine and the conversations. And then what we're forgetting is the sitting in the closet and trying to work on your fancy conference presentation in the middle of the night because you've been bothered by social events all day.
Or blithely interrupted by family members who are used to having the run of the house. Robert Down knows this. He's someone I interviewed last year about nursing.
Not everybody can go work the front lines. Not everybody has the knowledge set to go be a nurse.
At the time, I was taking an extended working holiday at my parents'.
Hi, Dad.
Sorry, my dad just walked in. I'm doing an interview.
Hi, are you a nurse?
I am a nurse, yes.
All right. I won't interrupt any longer.
It was a pleasure to meet you.
It's just that I live here and there's stuff in this room I need.
Yeah.
Fair point. It's tough for parents too.
You know, it's really hard to know when someone is doing something where they need silence.
Kimberly Edelston is a management professor at Northeastern University.
At one moment, they're in your living room. Another moment, they're in the office. Another moment, he's in his bedroom.
Edelston is an expert on work-family issues and still couldn't help but annoy her adult son when he was working at her house around Thanksgiving.
I had him put, you know, just a little post-it on his door, like, you know, do not enter, because, you know, he was home and I was being the mom doing the laundry and walking in his room, dropping piles of laundry, and there he was on the phone call.
She says setting a schedule for yourself and communicating it clearly to your family can help alleviate some of the confusion whether you do it with post-it notes or a conversation. She says even more important than protecting work from the distractions of family at this time of year is protecting family time from the distractions of work.
Make sure, you know, you do give yourself a break, you shut down. It does actually make us more productive and effective.
Though she says it is okay to excuse yourself for a work call when family fun starts to turn into an argument. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
The Consumer Price Index, the CPI that Sabri and Sam were talking to us about, tells us what people are paying. To find out how people are feeling, though, you got to ask them. So we called Gail Harrell the other day. She's one of the 10 people we first started talking to for our series, The United States of Work. She's a part-time cashier at a Royal Farms convenience store, and she lives with her son, Kevin, in Loudoun County, Virginia.
Everything's pretty much, I don't want to say I'm a creature of habit, but everything's pretty much the same. I still like to travel. A couple of our cruises were canceled because of COVID. So I did go on one in September to Alaska. And I'm still working at Royal Farms, going on 5 years in February. I've had three store leaders since I've last talked to you. They go and they come. I don't usually have a problem getting along with anybody. So we don't get a discount, but if you have a loyalty card, you get an extra few cents off. Mostly everything has gone up. I'm like, wow. I used to buy like a half a loaf of bread at Wegmans. I've seen that go up a little bit. The biggest thing, I guess, is prescriptions. They cost so much, and I do have to take them. But with my insurance, I'm lucky. I only have to really pay for one. So I just can't complain. And I think it has to do with Kevin, my son. If I were by myself, I think that definitely would be a difference. So I love living with my son. Still my heart.
That was Gail Harrell and her dog, RG3. She's a football fan, Gail is. They're in Loudoun County, Virginia. Take a minute, would you, and tell us about your economy. You can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, I saw this on Quartz, some analysis of census data by Morgan Stanley. That data from the census shows almost half of young adults in this country aged 18 to 29 still live with their parents, 48% of them last year, expected to remain there this year in this late-stage pandemic economy. Here, though, is the marketplace of it. Those living arrangements, Morgan Stanley says, are giving young adults more disposable income, money that they are spending on travel and entertainment and luxury goods. All right, here's your moment of economic context as we leave you. Maybe it's going to be a while before crypto gets its mojo back. Reuters reported today that a crypto exchange company called Binance, it is actually the biggest crypto exchange, paused withdrawals of a U.S. dollar-backed stablecoin for a while today. Stablecoins, as I think we might have mentioned once or twice, are meant to be stable against the dollar. Anyway, an exchange pausing withdrawals, that ain't great, crypto or no. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mantinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director over at that part of the Marketplace Empire. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.